Howdy. It's my pleasure to welcome you to the 2024 Fall Eminent Scholar Lecture of the Hegler Institute for Advanced Study. My name is Clifford Fry. I'm Associate Director of the Hegler Institute. The director is off in New York giving seminars, and so I'm going to have the privilege of introducing our guest speaker, Dr. Myers. But it's a pleasure, particularly, to welcome the students here from the Undergraduate University Research Honors Program and the University Research Program, I'm sorry, and the University Honors Program. And it's a pleasure to have you here. Some of you may not be familiar with the Hegler Institute. I'll just briefly say that the Hegler Institute was formed in 2012 to help Texas A&M achieve a top-tier status among universities and to be recognized as a global research and academic leader. So how do we help accomplish something like this? We every year bring in a whole group of world-renowned scholars into A&M for up to a year's time to collaborate with our faculty and students. And there are a lot of benefits to this I won't go into. for time reasons, but since its inception, the Hegler Institute's brought in 135 fellows and 11 distinguished lecturers, all of these people A-plus in their profession, big leaders in their profession. The fellows stay for up to a year. We've had 6 Nobel Prize winners, but every one of these people are tops in their field. 16 have joined our faculty, and they've been a catalyst for other top professors to join our faculty. But I would say that none of these people would be interested in coming here if it weren't for the outstanding faculty of Texas A&M that's already here. And we honor those people in helping us bring these people in. They're the ones that nominate the fellows and host them. And the benefits flow both ways. Today, I'm honored to introduce Dr. Kyle Myers. Your program should have one of these. This is a lot more about her than I'm going to say up here. I don't want to take her time, but I want to say that she earned a bachelor's degree in mathematics and physics from Occidental College in Los Angeles. She went on to the University of Arizona to earn her PhD in optical science. She joined the Food and Drug Administration in 1987, where she eventually rose to become the Director of Imaging and Applied Mathematics in the FDA's Center for Devices and Radiological Health. She's now the president of Puente Solutions, which is her own company located in Phoenix, Arizona. She's the author of numerous journal articles and 2 books, one of which is an award-winning book by the Optical Society. She was inducted into the National Academy of Engineering in 2015 for developing methods to assess the safety and effectiveness of medical imaging devices. So Dr. Myers joined the Hegler Institute in the 2023-2024 academic year, and she is collaborating with faculty and students in A&M's Department of Biomedical Engineering. She'll speak to us today about medical technology and artificial intelligence as they pertain to the future of medical imaging. And I'm my pleasure to welcome Dr. Myers.
Thank you. Let's see if this works. It's my great pleasure to be here. I want to echo what Clifford said. What brought me here was the excellence of the faculty here. And I have just really appreciated the strive for excellence and the breadth of opportunity here and your culture. So this is a really broad talk because I know this is a broad audience. And I'm really glad to see so many of you that can fill in some of the elements of this that I'm not going to be able to get to today. But I hope you can see some of the opportunity that I want to speak about in this topic, this big topic of building a metaverse for medical technology and AI. I'm going to be describing some building blocks and use cases with medical imaging as my foundation, but I hope that you'll be able to see how it generalizes to work that might be more relevant to whatever your areas of interest are. So what is a metaverse? Probably a lot of people have seen this definition. It's an integration of physical and virtual realities, enabling humans and their avatars to interact, supported by technologies such as high-speed internet. And we have the mother of internet here. It's great to see you, Radia. So if anybody has internet questions, Radia is here. Mixed, extended, virtual, augmented reality, blockchain for sharing data in a secure way, digital twins, artificial intelligence. What's the foundation for all of this? A lot of data. We need data. And I'm going to talk about how we get to more data through the use of methods outside of real data. So this is our concept that we published for a metaverse of specifically medical technology and AI to facilitate the development, prototyping, evaluation, regulation, that's me, translation and refinement of AI-based medical practice, especially medical practice as it is associated with medical imaging guided therapies. So what are the building blocks for this? Well, you'll see here, I'm not sure I can do a You'll just have to follow my words because it's really hard to do a pointing behind me. Then I'm going to talk about these essential building blocks: virtual scanning, data sharing, augmented regulatory science, and metaverse medical interactions and interventions. Now, some of you might find this vision exciting, perhaps inevitable, but others might find these words unfamiliar and strange, and look back in fondness with the historical notion of personal medicine. But I hope to provide you with examples for why this vision leads to greater access to better medicine, indeed better personalized medicine, with medical imaging as a compelling use case. So let's start with perhaps the most surprising of the building blocks, that is advances in regulatory science. You may think of FDA as a stodgy place filled with lawyers. I'm here to tell you about the FDA that I know, where scientists are making significant contributions, enabling the other building blocks for the healthcare metaverse. Indeed, for FDA to be involved is key, because many of the underlying technologies we saw in that graphic will require FDA market authorization. So FDA regulates a grand variety of imaging and other diagnostic devices. Devices include imaging acquisition hardware, as well as software tools, computer-aided diagnosis and AI, other machine algorithms for image processing, image reconstruction, that provide decision-making support to clinicians. Devices also includes image visualization tools like augmented reality systems, and those are already being authorized by FDA for various medical claims related to surgical planning, image visualization, and more. However, as much as this technology universe is complex, the approach often found today in the literature looks something like this. There's some new image processing analysis that's been developed by some highly theoretical and outstanding investigator who lays out in a paper a background for that work, the motivation in 20 pages of equations or more, and then comes up with this rationale for the results. Hey, here's the original image. My algorithm is clearly better at reconstructing that than the alternative. Well, I can tell you that that is very, very common, but it is not what FDA defines, and we have a definition for valid scientific evidence. For FDA to authorize a new imaging device, the company has to show two things. First, there have to be clinically significant results. If you're going to spend your money, plunk your money down on a new technology, you need to be assured that it does something beneficial, and FDA ensures that that is the case. Moreover, because most technologies also have a downside, and that will depend on the imaging technology, you have to show that the benefits outweigh the risks. And that sounds simple, but really there's a lot of quantitative decision-making that goes inside making those determinations. So what is a better imaging system? It's one that fulfills a medically important purpose, one that allows for better inferences about the object. And more precisely, better imaging systems today are ones that create better images on average, because there isn't an imaging system today that is designed uniquely for me, differently from you. So we have to think about what that means in terms of the statistical properties of the property of the people or the task for which the image is being collected. And comparison of an image, like we saw in that scientific paper, it can be indicative, but it's not sufficient. It might be enough for you to decide which cell phone to buy or which next high-def TV you want, but it's not enough for the FDA. We embrace a particular science, the science that we term image science, which talks about objective measures of image quality. And there are approaches to that that have been emerging over time. And as new claims are being made, new uses of imaging systems, that builds out this measurement science so that we're able to measure what is not measurable today, tomorrow. And so quantitative assessment of image quality follows this pipeline. We have to consider the purpose for which the image is collected, what decision or inference is being made on that information, and by whom. And we're going to talk about whom. Is that a human? Is that an AI? Or both? It must take into account the deterministic and stochastic properties of imaging systems. All imaging systems create noisy data, and physicists and mathematicians and engineers need to understand that and how that limits the information carrying capacity of the system. It must take into account the person at the input to the imaging system and the biological variability across the population for that particular claim. Okay, it also then has to result in a quantitative figure of merit that summarizes the quality of an imaging system so we can say, yep, this system is better than that one. And moreover, we need to be able to say that statistically with meaningfully developed rigorous error bars. Tools for simulating each of these steps along the imaging pipeline are going to be a focus of my presentation, because as you look at this pipeline, you can see, I think, quite readily the challenge in not just designing imaging systems, but designing better ones and optimizing them when there are notably going to be not just benefits to better imaging systems, but potential harms. So you don't want to be exposing patients to systems that are really not fit for purpose. Okay, so I'm not going to get into the mathematics of decision-making around and statistics related to image quality assessment. I know this is a really broad audience, but I am going to be showing this kind of graph for describing the ability of an imaging system to convey information to and through an observer to make a classification task. Patients do or do not have disease. Okay, so that data from those two sets of patients will have spreads. And an ROC curve comes from communication theory, is a way of summarizing how well a particular imaging system being used by an observer is able to perform that task. So worthless systems are diagonal lines. Better systems are up in the upper left corner. That's where we want our imaging methodologies to go. And that's all you need to know about the graphs that I'm going to show you. But I really want to hammer home that those distributions represent all the sources of variability along the imaging chain. So better imaging systems pull that data apart. Bad observers, and I'm going to give you some examples, even for good data, will result in overlaps in those distributions. And we'll see that in the summary figures of merit. Okay, so how do we know a new technology is ready for prime time? Where prime time means, if you're wearing an FDA hat, as I did for so many decades, I'm making a decision that allows for a device to be on the market that is going to result in decisions that will affect me as a patient, my friends, my family, and actually the entire US population. So I'm going to give you a story from digital mammography to get you in this game. Okay, so in the 1990s, that's when digital data started to become available to us because digital detectors were becoming mature. And radiographic imaging was moving digital. Now, mammography was the slowest technology to get to market. And I want to tell you why. There were a couple of reasons for that. Number one, there's a really big difference between finding disease in patients that don't have signs or symptoms. That's what we call screening. That means for patients who are being presented, whether it's lung cancer screening, colon cancer screening, screening for heart disease, mammography, this is my example, but think broadly. As a nation, we want to find disease earlier where it's easier to treat. We're more likely to have better outcomes, less expense, more health for our population. The downside is that we're going to be doing a lot of imaging acquisitions on patients that don't have disease. The prevalence of breast cancer in a screening population is about 4 cancers per 1,000. And the goal of a breast cancer imaging developer is to develop better tools for finding more of those 4 per 1,000. So radiology it's well known that mammography is the most challenging imaging exam, both because of prevalence, because of exposure of radiation to patients who don't have disease, and because of what I'm pointing to in my second bullet here, which is that in terms of what you're looking for, the detail is quite fine. And so there were very significant questions around whether or not the trade-offs in going from digital, from film to digital, were going to result in better inferences about patients, or whether we were going to, in fact, miss cancers because, I mean, we're thinking about a time when the technology is not fully mature. Pixels are getting smaller and smaller. Are they small enough to be able to tell a spiculated cancer from a benign mass? Are they able to find and size and tell the shape of microcalcifications? Are we going to miss cancers? Are we going to have more false positives? That's the downside of making the decision too early to let this technology go to market. So this is my cartoon, excuse my silly drawing here, to give you a different way of thinking about this. Because, you know, in those old days, we used linear systems theory all the time to talk about the trade-off that engineers were making between resolution and noise and large area contrast in film systems, and companies would compete in presenting those curves. So what I'm showing here is a compressed breast with an embedded mass. And I've magnified the image of that mass. Imagine that that's what we're looking to image. And now I've plotted the quantum efficiency of these two competing detecting technologies, digital and film. Film is continuous. And so you can see that it runs very far to the right in terms of how much detail it's able to convey in the image. On the other hand, a digital technology runs out of resolution at the Nyquist frequency. So you can see this trade-off. One has more quantum efficiency in the lower contrast area and lower size area, larger spatial frequencies, and one has more ability to detect fine detail. And so what I'm trying to show with those arrows above the graph is the way in which this task is manifest in terms of finding a blob, that's the lowest spatial frequency requirement for the system. Telling how big it is, that takes a little more frequency content, and being able to see those microcalcifications and hear the spiculations drives the requirement for finer detail. And at the time, nobody knew which was going to win. Okay, so it was decided that because physics didn't tell us enough about how this trade-off was going to play out, the requirement was put out there for the companies that were developing these systems to bring clinical data to the FDA to answer the question in a task-based, meaningful way. Well, the problem was that about the same time this came out, we're thinking we're going to do an evaluation, a measurement of the image quality of a mammography system in the hands of users. And lo and behold, Craig Beam sent 108 US radiologists, all the same 79 mammograms. They're on film, so we can print them in envelopes and send them around and say, send them back to me marked by, do they go to biopsy or not? What's your call on these images? And so these are single operating points for each of those 108 radiologists. And what do you see? A lot of dispersion in the data. What that tells us is that for that particular threshold, he was driving a threshold, a decision threshold, 1 point on their underlying ROC curve. They don't have a fixed threshold across this population. They don't have the same level of skill. We can see that there's a range of skills, and you would sure love to have your radiologist's ROC curve, wouldn't you? Because you want the one that's in the upper left corner, but who would know? So the next time you think about getting a second opinion, you're going to remember my graph and you're not going to be embarrassed to go do that, right? But as an FDAer, the challenge is, how do you evaluate imaging technologies in the face of this variability? Now, this made front page news in the New York Times, and became something that really needed to be addressed with new statistical tools. You should not be surprised that I have a stack of slides that look just like this. I already said that mammography is the most challenging. It's also the most regulated imaging procedure. We regulate facilities, we regulate technologists who set the patients up and run the scanners, and we actually have uniquely high requirements for mammographers in this country through the Mammography Quality Screening Act. So I've given you a little time to look at this image. This is five readers. So five readers looking at three sets of images with three different levels of resolution. And what you can see is that the range in reader scale absolutely swamps the differences in the technology. So cast your eye on the thick dashed lines. One, two, three, four, five. Those are five radiologists all reading the images with the worst resolution. And so what you can see is you want this guy or gal, right? And the other curves are for medium and low. Again, the technology differences are being swamped by the readers. So this is a real problem. Craig Beam was not telling us something that was odd and somehow a problem because of his experimental paradigm. Okay, so what we came to appreciate is that we needed to build out the tools that we had, you know, had inherited from communications theory, specifically to address the unique challenges in imaging, that an image is a vast amount of data. And on top of that, there's an observer that has to create a decision from that. And we needed what we now refer to as multi-case, multi-reader ROC analysis to account for those underlying sources of variance that come from the biology, the spread in the patients, the measurement noise in the imaging system, the imaging protocol and platform variations, and how you reconstruct the data and how you display it, and variability in the readers we've just talked about. And for those of you who think AI is the solution to this, I can tell you that evaluations of AI at FDA follow a very similar statistical framework. Why? Because as long as we have finite data sets, the data represents is isomorphic with the skill of a reader, and the architecture influences the skill. And when you have an AI system do the same task of deciding whether or not patients do or don't have disease, you have to set a threshold. So it's very, very similar in terms of decision theory today. Okay, so back to multi-reader, multi-case. Now we've got our tool. We're ready to go look at the digital mammography clinical trial that was done in the hands of users. This is the first data set that came in from GE. They got to the finish line first and brought to us a clinical trial that had 625 female subjects. Now they're both imaged in standard of care, which is film mammography, and this technology that we don't know how good it is. Okay, so we may be exposing them to an imaging procedure that's really not fit for purpose, but that's the way the world works, right? And especially back then. Five readers read each of those images. It was what we call fully crossed. That's important to use correlations between readers, and we're using correlations between cases. That brings down some of the variability in the components of variance. And what did we learn? The technologies look, in terms of area under the ROC curve, substantially equivalent. The issue was they didn't hit their margin on their endpoint. It's above 0.05. And so FDA was left with this quandary. Are we really going to say yes to a technology that's substantially equivalent to film screen mammography? Or is it possible that it's 0.05 or 0.06 worse? And we're imposing it across the entire US population of women in a screening environment. Well, thanks to MRMC analysis, we're able to look at the variant structure that is able to be teased out from the clinical data and figure out how much of the variation comes from cases and how much comes from readers, and say, how would we increase the size of the study to meet the error bars that we want to be able to tell the difference between these two technologies, if indeed one exists? And so if our goal is a 95% confidence interval of half of what the company achieved, this is what it would take. And you can see pretty quickly, we're growing a very large trial, especially when you think about screening, where there are only 4 to 5 cancers per 1,000. So in the end, FDA, with some support from our advisors, because we took this to a panel, agreed that there was sufficient assurance of safety and effectiveness to allow for this technology to go to market. The bottom line there is that there weren't any number of readers for 44 cancers that was going to meet the endpoint. They would have had to go get more data, and we decided to allow for it to go to market. And then we waited. We waited because NCI, not long after that, the National Cancer Institute, launched a screening trial, because this was of national importance. We need to know if we are doing harm to women or if the digital technology is indeed fit for purpose. So the results of this came out some years later. And since you're all experts in ROC analysis now, you can see that the digital technology is better than film on average over all women with verified cancer status. More importantly, what we learned and what we didn't have the subgroup data to do with the small studies that came to the FDA is to say, wow, it's a lot better for women with heterogeneously dense and extremely dense breasts. And that's because while it doesn't have the same frequency response out to fine details, it has a lot more dynamic range, and it's able to better get information for women with dense breasts. So one of these conclusions that you can draw is a study like this is really expensive. $30 million it took. 42,000 plus women across 33 institutions, and that only yielded 335 cancers. So when you think about AI and the desire to train systems that have seen a lot of exemplars of cancers, you can kind of get an idea for why it is that even that proposition is pretty challenging. Which leads us to the need for comparative scanning in the computer. This is where we've got to go. And this is the connection to the metaverse. And especially what we really want to see is more adoption of computer generated evidence in the regulatory environment. So this is our vision that we put out for the future of computational modeling. We launched a medical device innovation consortium to work with companies that we knew were in the modeling space. We said, we know that you do a ton of virtual prototyping. We know that you do a lot of modeling to understand when things go wrong. And we know you do a lot of optimization. We want you to start bringing that data, and our promise to you is, in return, we are going to build a future where we're going to ask less clinical data of you. So let's work on this together in terms of how that might go forward. So I think I've made the case, I hope, that you can see the importance and the promise for in silico clinical trials in medical imaging. And after that digital versus film screen mammography trial, we were already rolling up our sleeves and getting to work on building models that would support this kind of a future. Because especially for novel imaging systems that involve ionizing radiation, where there are a large number of design parameters and, you know, the issue around exposing patients to radiation, computational modeling offers such advantages in terms of reproducibility. It can be reproduced by somebody else with their software or yours. Reduced exposure. We play God, so we have a reference standard. We don't have to wait for biopsy or follow-up. And the ability to look at subgroups. So I'm ready to talk about Exhibit B, which is digital breast tomosynthesis. Okay, so DBT is a limited angle tomography add-on option to mammography. It says, hey, the companies were saying, you know, mammography is a projection imaging system. A little bit of 3D information could help us tease apart overlapping structures. And so Siemens, this is their PMA, designed a clinical trial to show that digital breast tomosynthesis was at least as good as mammography and could replace digital mammography. To do that, we see another very similar size trial to the one that I showed you for digital mammography. 400 plus women, double exposed to both the standard, which is now digital mammography at this time, and digital breast tomosynthesis. We have to biopsy the women where there were cancer calls to make sure that we're scoring true positives correctly and determining false positives. And we need 30 plus radiologists, 6 plus clinical sites, 6 years, millions of dollars. Well, we were ready. So we launched an effort to show that we could simulate every aspect of that clinical trial. We developed an ability with procedural models to simulate the breast and simulate its compression. We had been already developing and giving away radiation transport code for modeling the imaging formation process. So you can see here the modeling of DBT as a moving of the X-ray source in an arc above the breast. Now, in this case, we're not using an AI, observer that's intended to beat the human, because we're trying to replicate the clinical trial. A subsequent natural question is, would we do better with an AI observer? But our goal here was to show that we could replicate the actual trial that was being done. So the way the model observer was designed was based on what is quite known in the perception field around how observers read mammograms. So that's what was coded up. Images were evaluated. Those ROC distributions were determined, and ROC curves and figures of merit were developed. What was our success criteria? I like this, that a regulatory decision would be at least as good as the one that came from the physical trial, and we would be faster and cheaper, one or the other, if not both. So here's just an example showing the computational model, giving across the notion that you can have an infinite number of virtual patients, right? Of all different sizes and shapes of masses, you get to decide how you want to, how many of those. That's not possible, right, in a clinical trial. And I already told you that pairs of images should not be taken seriously. So this is just for fun, to show the realistic anatomy that comes out of the model and the realistic physics, and how at least subjectively, it looks similar to that of the real data. But that's not what we're going to use for our decision-making process, right? We're going to look at the clinical and the in silico trial endpoints. The graph is a little bit small here to show you, but this is not only the overall endpoint, but subgroups, women with dense breasts, women with masses versus microcalcifications. Bottom line, we replicated the clinical trial results. And not only that, it was by, we not only said that, yep, digital breast tomosynthesis is better than digital mammography, but to the exact absolute same level. And what's important in addition to that is we were able to show we could do it in a fraction of the time and the cost. Furthermore, there's this cost leveraging that happens, right? Because once the tools have been developed, we can give them away. And now you can use them to not just look at the Siemens system as it was designed, but consider alternatives to that design, consider different observers. So there's a lot of ways in which that data continues to give. And in fact, FDA has been over time growing the acceptance, augmenting our regulatory approach in this building of a metaverse by using a virtual assessment framework. So I have a couple of examples here. One, looking at a fast display with a claim for being able to roll through images and not have lags such that a small blip in a slice would be missed by a radiologist. Another for looking at the ability to reconstruct very noisy images that are intended to bring down the high exposure of CT and still result in diagnostically useful information. MR heating using virtual families has been something that FDA has accepted for a very long time for assessing compatibility of implants. The last thing that you would want is to do human studies with a brand new implant, putting patients into an MR environment and seeing whether indeed the implant heats under various imaging protocols or not. And we give the MRMC software away. So, a lot of people, I'm sure, in this room and across campus are working in computational modeling. And that is fantastic. Again, most of that I know is for developing new systems and understanding them. How good is good enough for regulatory decision making? Well, I gave you one possible answer to that. that the decisions would be the same or better in less cost or faster time. I like that definition, but there is this problem. And the problem is that that means we always have to have the clinical trial to compare to. I mean, I guess we could try to make an estimate of how much a trial costs. And there is a way of doing that, but I still think that, you know, it's a nice decision, but it has some drawbacks. The other possibility is to not wait until you have a model that is so good it can let the real data go. Instead, we can leverage Bayesian trial methods. Now, Bayesian methodologies are used by statisticians all the time to pull in what we call OUS or outside the US data or historical data. So why not use data from computational models and have a weight that represents the credibility or the agreement or the relationship between the virtual data and the real data? It's very similar to what happens with OUS or other forms of data collected elsewhere outside of a prospective trial. So the methodology for that looks something like this. You take your virtual data from your comparative scan, you compare it to the real data. I'm only showing two distributions here. This is a therapy device example that we published. You compute the strength of the agreement between those two, and that gives you a discount function that drives how much you're going to allow the virtual patients to have strength in determining your posterior, your final assessment of your output data. So you combine those together. And this is super important because, of course, you know, you can't just talk about N samples in a real trial and N from a virtual trial, virtual patients, because I could make millions of these. So we have to have some way of discounting them. And there's a rigorous statistical way of doing that. So I really like this idea because it means that we can start today with clinical data, this much of a requirement. We're building up our computational model. Eventually, the weights go this way. And eventually, we can let, if not all, a lot of the clinical data go. Okay, but we still need data, don't we? We need data sources. We need data sharing for patient models to develop these computational approaches. You want data for AI development, and we need data to build out this metaverse. So where are we going to get data? Well, one of the things that we just want to go back to is how clinical data drives models and clinical data is used to validate models. It's really, you know, that's at the highest level, that is the truth. So I already said one of the ways that people build data is by procedural models. We did this in the breast. People do this in building out, you know, vascular trees or airway models. It's quite common. I think the most important thing is that we move to democratizing our models and democratizing the data, sharing back models that have been developed from shared data. Another approach is to put together hybrid or augmented clinical data sets. So in this slide, what I'm talking about is combining clinical backgrounds with edited clinical lesions to create larger data sets. Why might we do that? Because remember, especially for early disease detection, we're always going to have a lot more realizations of data that does not have pathology. A lot more normals, a lot of sampling of the backgrounds. And so what is helpful, if we're not able to replicate in silico the background to a sufficient level of realism, you can surgically insert edited, either modeled lesions or ones that have been extracted from pathological images to create a larger family while still having backgrounds that are realistic. So there's an example here where we're taking clusters of microcalcifications from a breast and putting them into a normal background to make another exemplar of a breast with microcalcifications, an example from lung cancer where we're moving nodules around, and then a Mayo Group effort in the area of liver cancer. Very common approach. pointing the laser at there. So here in the biomedical engineering department, Dr. Avaz and his students are creating in silico databases from CT images for assessing regional lung mechanics under motion. Here is shown in this workflow. And this is just so important. I've only shown you static images now, but of course, there's such a need for developing models that add in organ motion, that add in blood flow. So using motion mapping from a series of CT images, you can generate in silico lung phantoms to provide us with powerful tools for assessing dynamic imaging and image registration methods without exposing humans to repeated exams involving ionizing radiation. Another area of investigation in Dr. Avaz's group, and he's here and his students are here, is the development of models for the pulmonary vasculature to investigate changes in hemodynamics with pulmonary hypertension to predict changes in mechanical behavior in the heart. Here again, there's this beautiful, this virtuous cycle, getting information from images that drive the development of models, being able to use the models to ascertain potential biomarkers for disease, optimizing the imaging to further be able to extract that information from the images. I bet some of you are waiting for me to say generative adversarial networks. Anybody? We've seen so many examples of the success of these kinds of algorithms for making beautifully realistic faces. And so, of course, it's a natural question to say, what role do they play in building models for patients, since that's one of the areas of need in this field? Well, we had that same question. So we launched a grand challenge through the American Association of Physicists in Medicine. And here again, we're leveraging the breast models that we've developed. We put thousands of them out there for competitors to be able to use them as training data for developing GANs that would replicate the statistics of these images. And what we found is that while the standard similarity measures like SSID and FID might be ones that would be shown to be, high for some of the competitors, those measures are not guaranteed to preserve the clinical information in terms of the statistical information in these images that are needed for task-based performance assessment. So the jury is still out on how to ensure that models like these are credible. They clearly need different approaches to training and the way that we drive loss functions to match the biologically important information for our purposes. But modeling data like these really is a tool for investigating those questions, because now we can look at how much more data do we need? What happens as a function of how much data, and what types of GAN are we considering? So AI, we've put our toe in the AI water now. More than 950 medical devices with integrated AI functionalities have now been authorized by FDA, a huge increase from 2018 to 2023, 75%. And you can see here from this graph, this middle space is radiology. 75% of the action in this field is radiology. That's where the data are. That's where the intuition tells us that there is a need for that based on reader variability and the kind of tasks that we know AI is well suited for. So here are some recent innovations in AIML. It's super interesting, though, to point out that nothing has been authorized yet that doesn't have a risk mitigator, which is a human looking over its shoulder. So AI is looking over the human's shoulder, humans looking over the AI. They're working together. There are different ways that companies situate these in the workflow, and that drives the study design. But what you can see here is we have AI-enabled detection algorithms, detection of breast lesions, detection of diabetic retinopathy. That's a particular study design and endpoint. You can have classification algorithms like the one here for characterizing breast abnormalities, where the radiologist finds it, the computer assesses it. There are AI-enabled guidance algorithms now that support getting better cardiac data in the hands of sonographers that aren't expert. And there are triage systems that make sure that time-intensive, timely readings of images happen sooner than later, for example, in stroke, where time is brain. So in all of these cases, the regulatory decision-making is based on a task-based approach, task-based performance measures, using lots of data to ensure that when these are released in the wild, they work generally across patients. And this is the first triage device. So you can see it does a really good job of finding the images that need to be read first. Because what's the downside of an algorithm that doesn't work well? It sticks images at the bottom of the stack that should be read first. And FDA's job is to ensure that does not happen. Now, I'm very pleased to see how many emerging data sources are coming to the fore. I'm very involved in the Medical Imaging and Data Resource Center, so I'll tell you about that next. And FDA has its fingerprints on this as well. FDA just called for the development of a medical imaging data marketplace. We need data. ARPA-H is building out a system for matching data owners with data, with people who would be data users. That's coming. We've had some, they've had some online discussions and collecting information from potential users on what would be successful models for making this happen. In the form of MIDRIC, now MIDRIC was established as a response to COVID by the National Institute of Biomedical Imaging and Bioengineering to create a public data community, starting with COVID cases, because many AI systems were developed early in COVID to separate people with COVID pneumonia from other forms of pneumonia to appropriately treat them. And most of that fell flat on its face for lack of data. So MIDRIC has already ingested over 500,000 imaging studies and released them, many of them, to the public. The others are either going under QA/QC or are being held back by my team, where we are creating a sequestered commons specifically for third-party evaluation of the algorithms, so we don't see algorithms that are inadvertently tested on data that they were trained on. So we intend to accelerate data set evaluation and regulatory approval through this model. So I've been all talking about population models, and that figure said something about digital twins. So what's the difference? Well, digital twins are a way of talking about the need for an actual physical person like you or me being replicated in the computer, having a digital counterpart. And we would build that up, imagine, over time. You have many different sources of data in your electronic health record. And where we see this headed is not just talking about optimizing systems over a population, but imagine doing a clinical trial and an N of one. So that sounds weird, but there still are sources of variability, right? There are sources of variability around your biological variability, the variability in the imaging system, all the choices around how we might collect the images, and what we're looking for. And you might have signs or symptoms that are consistent with a few things. And so we can, in silico, optimize an imaging system that would serve the needs of appropriately and effectively being able to optimize an imaging system that would work for you. And so I think it's really exciting that NSF, NIH have partnered with FDA, because we know while there's a lot of work in digital twins that's gone on in other areas of engineering, much less in medical applications, and certainly nothing that has been brought to the FDA in this regard. FDA is very interested in seeing this future move forward and has seen to it that NSF and NIH are funding work that will support not just computational models being accepted by FDA, but optimizing imaging systems with claims that companies could make that would be patient specific. So I was excited to see this as I was preparing this talk a month or so ago that Texas A&M just launched from the Data Science Institute, a research collaborative, a development effort in their digital twin lab. I haven't knocked on their door yet, but they're very interested in supporting any of you that are interested in pushing your work more into this domain of doing specific models of specific objects. So I'm winding down. We put the patient at the center of this graphic deliberately, intending to articulate the promise of a patient-centered and patient-specific health enterprise with shared data, shared models, connected and collaborative efforts, as well as regulatory agency readiness. We can build a future where no patient is left behind. You all would be able to have access to the best of an image interpretations and the optimization of scans through this vision. And so I end with this quote because it's putting patients together at the center of this future vision that we're all looking to build that means no person would be left behind in healthcare. So I thank you for your attention and I look forward to answering your questions.
Hi, Dr. Mayer, thank you for the great talk. I'm a faculty of computer science, working on machine learning AI, particularly optimizing all kind of measures for learning or machine learning model. Mm-hmm. So recently we have been working on algorithms to optimize AUC for learning on machine learning model, right? So our algorithm also won the first place at the CHEXPERT, Stanford CHEXPERT competition for recognizing X-ray images because they use AUC as a performance
measure.
I know
the data well.
Yeah, but I have a question here, right? So, you know, we know that AUC look at the true positive rate, false positive rate in the whole range from 0 to 1, right?
Yep.
But in practice, we may only interested in the model that has low false positive rate or high true positive rate, right? So in this case, I think we should look at the partial error and the curve, right? So I'm wondering, because you know, if we just look at AUC, so a model with high AUC may not necessarily have a high partial error and the curve, right? Partial AUC, right? So I'm wondering if you have considered or FDA have considered using the partial AUC to assess the performance of a model?
Great question. Did everybody hear it and understand it? They're saying that, you know, there are lots of circumstances where you really only want to be in one part of that ROC space where you have low false positives. It's interesting, right, that when I showed you the data from Craig Beam, that the clinicians were all over the place. But when I show you the data from the digital mammography screening trial, you can see there are some very specific operating points, and then the far end is not so well populated. So there are statistically robust tools for evaluating partial area. And those can be used by companies. They're welcome to make a claim like that. What we really don't want to see, though, is making arguments about specific operating points. You know, sometimes companies will like to say, you know, my operating point over here has this true positive, false positive, and, you know, the technology, my competitor is over here. Because as you know, that can be the result of underlying ROC curves that can be either way, one or the other. So as a technology assessment organization, we like to see the full curve, but we understand that for the implementation, it may be that a partial area makes more sense. And then it's all about training users, which is a lot easier to do when you're talking about AI, setting thresholds. Readers oftentimes don't know where they're operating, and actually, patient by patient, they can move along their ROC curve. To, you know, that just is their skill. but where they're sitting depends on their costs. And as they, you know, they don't read images without having information about a patient's history and you know, smoking history, or the cost of making a right or wrong decision can be different for different people. And that will adjust their level of aggressiveness. A lot of data that shows that readers move. And so that's one of the reasons that we collect full data most of the time. Does that make sense?
Thank you.
We need to talk more afterwards because it's a really interesting topic.
Yeah.
Kind of in the details, but I appreciate that. Great.
Any other questions? Gonna have a reception.
You wanna turn it off?
First, Dr. Myers, I want to give you a memento of today. This is the Hegler Institute for Advanced Study, the Eminent Scholar Lecture Series. And thank you very much for your talk.
We have a lot of food back there and drink, and everyone is welcome to partake. And thank you very much for coming.